Today on Flashpoints, the military and the police clear downtown St. Paul in anticipation of John McCain's speech before the Republican National Committee and Convention. I'm Dennis Bernstein. We broadcast from St. Paul, where the streets are covered with police, Homeland Security, and soldiers. We broadcast to you from an undisclosed location. We have been cleared out of our building, our headquarters in the Indigenous Multicultural Academy. And I'm here with Bill Means, who was also cleared out of his building as the police went building to building, clearing people out. And Bill, before we hear a press conference that just took place about police violence and police overreaction, what's your response? We were told that at the school there was some kind of bomb threat. We had to leave, but it seems as though they had planned to clear out the entire downtown of St. Paul.
You know, early on, about 6 months ago, they started planning for this convention, and they told us to be ready. As employees, I don't work for the state, but the building I'm in is full of state employees. I work for Minnesota Indian OIC State Council. However, we are part of the state, gives us office space, so I'm in with approximately maybe 4,000 to 5,000 employees on at least three floors that we have in the what's known as the First National Bank Building, 5th Street in Minnesota in downtown St. Paul. But at about 11 o'clock this morning, we were all informed that by noon we had to be out of the building. So you can see it was a pretty mass evacuation in a short time. And the only reason we were given it was an order of Homeland Security. And there was no question, there was no asking why or any delay. They told us the time we had to be out, and that was it. So my secretary had gotten a word, called me, I had to go in, check things out, and everybody was leaving in a timely manner. But it was totally upsetting in the sense that masses of people, just on a word like Homeland Security, be ready to move, leave. There was no reason actually given. So there was a bit of, kind of very tense moments there because people don't know whether to run or take the elevator. Everybody go down the stairs. It's not a fire, but yet it's an imminent threat, as stated by the Homeland Security. So it was very upsetting and kind of nervous moments there. You don't know if people are going to get trampled or panic, but everybody seemed to go out fairly quickly, and I think that's because throughout the last 6 months, they've been telling us there may be times of evacuation, fire drills, etc. So we've been on alert, but it was very surprising and very tense to move that many people in that short a time.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. I'm Dennis Bernstein speaking with Bill Means. He is an official and on the board of the American Indian Movement here in Minnesota. We're in St. Paul. And Bill, before we go to this press conference where we're going to hear a great deal about what appears to be a conspiracy by the police and various levels of police, national security, federal police, before we go to that press conference, what do you think is at play here? What do you think the real story is, the real politic here?
Well, I think it's a practice run for implementing a form of martial law wherever it may be, whether in Minnesota, Florida, Arizona, along the border, wherever there's imminent danger of a mass law enforcement occupation. I think they're practicing for that, be it a military base, be it the border itself, down in the southwest, maybe it's federal buildings and landmarks, New York City, you know, all these places that have been targeted in the news media for possible terrorist threats. I think they're actually practicing, not only for that, but whatever may come as a result of police occupation. It's kind of like a militarization of the local job of protect and serve is going to a whole new level. From being a police watching a neighborhood, we now have Army, National Guard, U.S. Marshals, Homeland Security, FBI. We got this whole federal invasion, and they sort of push the local cops off to direct traffic, and they occupy your city. So it's like, what happened to states' rights? What happened to community input? What happened to the First Amendment?
Well, we're going to hear a lot more about what happened to it as we move into this press conference, which just happened a few minutes before airtime. We were there. The Flashpoints team was there here in St. Paul. Bill Means, we thank you for being our guest host. We've got one more day. We want to remind people that we will be live going national tomorrow from St. Paul, so you can tune into that live at 5 o'clock Pacific time, and now we go to the press conference about police violence and police overreaction in St. Paul in the shadows of the Republican Convention.
So my name is Bruce Nestor. I represent Monica Bicking, one of the eight charged at this time. And I guess when I say eight charged, I also want to say that, as many of you know, Monica was Bickman was released initially, and then when she went back to the jail in order to watch the bail hearings for the other people, she was taken into custody. And even though the sheriff saw fit to release her, and then she then showed up at the jail, the judge evidently decided she was a risk of flight and set bond again. But at that time, a Carrie Feldman was also arrested, and we believe are now facing the same probable cause riot charges. So we're now looking at least probably nine people rather than eight. Of that nine, eight have been released from custody. Three are here with us today, Max Spector, Lutza Guillen-Givens, and Robert Serznick. The fourth, Nathaniel Spector, is on his way. The other four just had bond posted for them within the past couple hours, and the jail's on lockdown for shift change until 3:30, so they're unable to join us as we expected. We also have the attorneys. Larry Leventhal is the attorney for Max Spector. Jordan Kushner is the attorney for Lutza Guillen-Givens, and I'm the attorney for Monica Bickman. Four of the others are currently represented by the Office of the Ramsey County Public Defender. And then for family members with us today, we have Mordecai Spector, the father of Max Spector, and Kira Fitzgerald, the father of Garrett Fitzgerald, who's one just been bailed out and is on our way over here. So I'm going to introduce Larry Leventhal, who's going to speak a little bit. But I just to summarize, all eight of these defendants have, and we're expecting it to be nine, have been charged with conspiracy to commit riot and furtherance of terrorism. Six people were picked up on Saturday, four at the house raids, two taken off the streets, none with criminal arrest warrants. One of our early complaints in this process was the fact that the sheriff claims this was a year-long investigation, that they have solid evidence to support their investigation, and yet they chose not to pursue criminal arrest warrants. They chose not to present the matter to the prosecuting attorney or to the court to approve a warrant, thereby really resulting in preventative detention of people, denying them access to court and denying them the opportunity to post bail had they been arrested prior to Saturday morning. Two other arrests then occurred in vehicle stops on Monday, I believe, and then with Ms. Feldman being the ninth arrest when she went to court on, must have been on Tuesday, I guess, or Wednesday morning. In particular, the charges in this case are supported only by allegations of paid confidential informants. A number of the attorneys here have experience in investigations with the use of informants in political cases. We are concerned about the potential use of provocateurs, people who purposely plan and bring up discussions of violence in order to get other people to respond and then report back that those discussions occurred. The confidential informants are paid based on the value of the information they provide. They have a clear incentive to exaggerate and lie about the information. The evidence in this case, the allegations of violence, the kidnapping of delegates, the most outrageous allegations made by the authorities are not supported by any evidence other than the statements of the confidential informants. were not supported by the evidence seized. We've also seen what appear to be fabrications with respect to descriptions of the evidence seized out of the homes. In particular, there's this ongoing repetition, both by Sheriff Fletcher and by the media, regarding the seizure of urine, when the actual pictures show, and it's easy to document, that those substances were mostly kitchen gray water and were not associated in any way with any of these defendants. We have other common household items being described repeatedly in the media as bomb-making materials, when what we're talking about are glass bottles, cloth rags, and charcoal lighter fluid, all of which were found separated from each other in different parts of houses, different houses, different locations, all of which are common household items, none of which were in any sort of assembled form. We have search warrants seeking gunpowder, explosive materials, Molotov cocktails, none of which were found. We have the sheriff displaying a single plastic item that he claims was a shield, as if somehow one shield was going to protect demonstrators from 3,500 armed riot police who have projectile tear gas weapons. And so overall, we question the mode and method of the investigation, the fact that the evidence seized does not support the allegations, and the use of a terrorism charge to take what were public statements of peaceful blockades of roads to equate that with terrorism, both trivializing the real violence and also putting anybody at risk who is organizing political demonstrations involving civil disobedience with the potential of being labeled a domestic terrorist. And with that, I'd ask Larry to make some comments.
There were complaints that were issued yesterday against eight individuals, which basically seek to bring the wrath of the state with big names of domestic terrorism, conspiracy, armed yet, which have no relationship to the facts as we've been able to see them to date. Rather, they take disparate statements made at different locations according to different informers and attempt to say that individuals who may or may not have been at a particular meeting subscribe to the most dramatic statement that the confidential informants cared to report. Thus, we have statements of bombs ready to blow up buildings and delegates ready to be kidnapped when there's been nothing like that. We see that they've put out names of people and said these individuals were all working together in a group, were all in communication with each other, and therefore anything that anybody said, even in another part of a country, is something that they're holding against them. What is interesting is if you look through this, there's a list of all sorts of things they expected, but if we ask, is there any of the defendants who is said to have physically attacked someone? Is there any of the defendants who is said to have physically even broken a window? And the information that they put in the complaint really does not present that. This is something that was put together before the convention started, and names were put in. A couple updates at the end were thrown there. And what they have weaved is a narrative of various meetings that they claim occurred over a number of years. We do not have the events. We have basically, they're saying, here are some people they've associated with other bad people, and those people have done bad things. If we were to accept the standard that people who associate with others who may do bad things are subject to arrest, and that certainly should not be a standard in a civilized society, but if that were the standard, there's a lot of delegates who are in the Excel Center that have been associating with bad people who have done very bad things. There's much more cause, it would seem, if the standard were those who associate with bad people, they should be inside, not outside the Excel Center. We have what has been initiated, a political prosecution. You can tell a political prosecution because people are being charged and sought and imprisoned for their thoughts, for their ideas, which may be different from the reigning political powers, rather than for things that they have done. And as we look through the papers we have, we see lists of what people were said to have said, and mostly not the any of the defendants, and saying they were going to do this, and we see this basis in search warrants where they find things like tires or gasoline or mirrors or things anybody has around the house and say, this is evidence of terrorism, this is evidence of people who have formed the conspiracy. What we are going to show is that what the evidence primarily shows is that there has been a campaign against people who do not believe as the Republican convention officials wish them to believe. And we can walk around the streets of St. Paul and see different police units on horseback, on motorcycles, on bicycles, wearing one form of riot gear or another form of riot gear. And when you get people together like that and told that their mission is to interfere with activities real or imagined, we can see why there has been police that have been overreacting, public officials that have been overreacting. And when you overreact, there seems to be a need to spin a web of things happening that are greater than anybody imagined and anybody was doing. And what we're seeing in the papers that are describing activities is such a web of he said that she said years ago, months ago, and someplace else, but these people talk to other people and they're all part of a conspiracy is what the claim is. We are pledged to show that that type of claim has no reality, and that type of claim does not fit into a democratic society where people are merely expressing views. It may be, and has been, that there have been broken windows and people taking actions that they shouldn't have had taken. But to attempt to say that people that they've singled out in advance are somehow responsible for things that happened when they weren't there, it gets to the area of where it becomes very improbable and becomes a manifestation of political statements rather than being anything that is a criminal act. If you separate the criminal acts from statements that are being made in allegations based upon he said that she said, we'll see that there is a very different reality that is actual from the web of circumstances which the government is trying to spin. Thank you. We have another attorney who's here, Jordan Kirshner, who will also have some remarks. Mm-hmm.
In the legislation that started being passed after 9/11, mostly on the federal level, but in the charges of this case on the state level, a lot of people who were concerned about civil liberties were warning about terrorism being used to go way beyond prosecuting anything that had to do with terrorism, that the laws that were being passed were so broad that they were obviously being used potentially to go after people based on legitimate political dissent and ultimately to suppress free speech and genuine movements for change in this country. We've gotten to that point now. First, they just went after people, didn't pay much attention because they captured people who are Muslim abroad and put them in detention camps here and overseas, and it didn't get much attention. It didn't get much attention when thousands of immigrants were placed in detention indefinitely. The warnings of civil liberties people were eventually it's going to come home. And that's what we're seeing here. We're seeing the state of Minnesota, in this case Ramsey County specifically, taking the lead in the most manipulative, cynical, demagogic in abusive fashion, or using the buzzword of terrorism to persecute people for political dissent, for having unconventional views. All they do is they label people as terrorists and anarchists, and at that point, what people are actually saying and the content of their views has no meaning anymore. What they do is they dehumanize people, they stigmatize them, and in the process, cut off what they're saying. And in this point, not only by marginalizing people and not paying attention to them, but actually using the criminal justice system as a severe bludgeon to cut off people in their efforts to be politically involved. In this case, we have, if you look at the complaint, there's the, which as has been pointed out, most of the allegations come from an informant who was paid money. And the way this works, and we know this from the, if you looked at the City Page article about the person who was approached to be a mole in anarchist groups, they were told that they would be paid based on the value of the information that they provided. So we're talking about someone who, how much money he makes depends on how bad he's, the accusations he's able to come up with. So we, first we have the government spying on a group that's engaged in political dissent. So we have a police spying type state. And we have propped up, trumped up allegations. And ultimately, people are being persecuted for actions that were accepted in this country as part of our tradition. We've had labor movements at the turn of the century and the Great Depression, and we've had the civil rights movements in the 1960s, where it's understood that when people aren't getting a voice in the country, they take it to the streets. They organize other people, they take it to the streets, and yes, they cause disruptions sometimes because in the unequal balance of power that we have, and more than ever, where how much you can get to the airwaves depends on how much you can buy, the only route people have left is to demonstrate and do grassroots street actions. And historically, that's always involved some degree of disruption, but we're talking ultimately about nonviolent disruption. We're talking about people trying to stop business from happening. That's what's alleged in the complaint. We're talking about traditional civil disobedience here, and that's being made out in this complaint to be about, and that suddenly turned into terrorism. And if you look at the state statute in Minnesota as to how terrorism is defined, it is just so broad that anything that that gets in the way of the government could be defined as terrorism. And they're using that extremely broad statute in the most abusive sort of way to prosecute political dissidents who are engaging in their most fundamental right and valued right in this country to express their views, organize other people, and convince them to participate in their expression of views with them, and then to preemptively arrest them purposely so that they can't actually participate in demonstrations, and then afterwards to charge them with felonies. The abuse here was the violence of the state. That's the closest thing that we've had here to terrorism in these protests. If you look at how those police were dressed, and I'm sure some people were here to see that in their Darth Vader outfits, $1.9 million spent on chemical irritants, which were sprayed indiscriminately on people all over the place, all kinds of riot gear, all on almost completely unarmed protesters who all they were doing was were marching in the street. That's where the abuse is taking place, and that's being covered up by going after ordinary people who are trying to engage in activism. My client is Lutza Guillen-Givens, and if you the allegations against her are that she was seen going to many meetings. She traveled around the country meeting with people, talking about participating in the actions to protest against the Republican National Convention. If you heard the prosecutor in court yesterday, all he talked about was how people were associated with the RNC Welcoming Committee. And so being associated with a group in and of itself becomes a crime. And that's the next thing that this is about. This is about guilt by association. If you associate with people that the government doesn't like, if you participate in groups to organize and advocate, now that becomes criminalized. I think this is a more dangerous precedent in this country that we probably had at any time since the World War I and the aftermath of World War I with the Palmer Raids, where people were indiscriminately rounded up based on political dissent and thousands of people were deported before World War I, where anti-war activists were sentenced to prison for their views. You know, you would have thought that we got way beyond that, that there was some level of historical consciousness, at least by the people making and enforcing the law, that that's not something you do, that people have a right to dissent. I mean, the last time we had a trial that prosecuted people for doing a street demonstration nationally was the Chicago 8 trial in 1968. And, of course, that made complete fools out of the government. It became very clear. And when the evidence comes out in this case, it's going to be the same thing. It's going to be about politically opportunistic, abusive, cynical people in power who are abusing the law to suppress legitimate dissent and suppress political organizing for their own manipulative political gain.
Larry, you want to introduce?
Yes, I'd like to introduce Mordecai Spector, who will have a few words to say. Mordecai is the father of Max Spector, who's standing to his immediate left. Max is one of the defendants who is charged in this broad-ranging complaint. Mordecai has a very unique perspective. He's not only the father of one of the defendants, father of Max, but he's the editor and publisher of the American Jewish World. So given other circumstances and other times, he'd be standing on the other side of the table, getting information and asking questions. And indeed, he's been covering the Republican National Convention. So I'd like to hear the thoughts of Mordecai Spector.
Just briefly, Mordecai is Mordecai, last name Spector. T-O-R. And then Jordan Kushner is J-O-R-D-A-N-K-U-S-H-N-E-R. Larry Leventhal, Larry L-E-V-E-N-T-H-A-L. And then my last name is N as in Nancy, E-S-T-O-R.
I'm Max's dad. I'm here as a concerned parent. It's been a stressful week for my wife and I. Max was arrested Monday and held in solitary confinement in the Ramsey County Jail for 2 days. Finally was arraigned late yesterday afternoon. I arranged for a bail bond and got him out last night. As you heard from the lawyers, the criminal complaint here is far-fetched, overblown, outrageous. And I'm in the newspaper business, so I encourage all the journalists here to look into the specifics of this complaint, see where the truth really lies here. The Max's house was raided, one of the three houses Saturday morning that was raided, and that seems to have set the tone, created more tension, which exploded on the streets of downtown St. Paul on Monday, with nearly 300 people being arrested. I'll just mention briefly that Max is from South Minneapolis. We live in South Minneapolis. Max has an older brother and a younger brother. He went to Seward Montessori School, South High School. He's in his third year at the University of Minnesota. As far as his Jewish education, he's a confirmand of the Temple of Aaron Synagogue Religious School and a graduate of the Talmud Torah of St. Paul Midrash Shah, the high school program there. So this is your domestic terrorist. Take a good look. I don't believe it at all. You know, give me a break.
We also have Clea Fitzgerald with us. Clea, do you feel like saying a few words? She's the mother of Garrett Fitzgerald, who, as I indicated earlier, is bailed out at this time, but is waiting for a shift change to be completed at the Ramsey County Jail in order to join us.
I'm Clea Fitzgerald. I'm Garrett's mom, and I don't have any prepared statement. I just hightailed it out of my classroom from Mankato to come here and try to see him. I haven't talked to him except for about 30 seconds yesterday morning that they allowed him to make a phone call. Otherwise, I haven't seen him or talked to him. So I don't know exactly what's going on. All I can speak to is the fact that he's got a heart as big as gold, as just a heart of gold, just huge. And he's always been a person from the time he was small who stuck up for the little guy. And the person who was suffering. And that's his motivation, I believe. I don't know what his plans were. I don't know I know he didn't do anything because he's been locked up since Saturday morning. And I know he's passionate about wanting to make life better for people who've been struggling, about wanting to make our community better, about wanting to make our country better, about wanting to make the whole world better and take care of the earth. And he used to be pretty involved politically, but he's obviously gotten a little discouraged by what's been going on for the last however many years. And he sees the same problems magnifying. And he must have thought that, I guess, it's time to have some courage and take a risk and try to get attention by, I don't know what. He did, made some plans to disrupt things with civil disobedience. So I'm sorry it happened. I admire my son for living the beliefs that he holds so dear. And I'd like to run down to the jail now and hope to see him as they get released. I hope so. Thank you all for giving me a chance to speak. But when I hear the word terrorist associated with my son, it makes me weep because he's such a committed humanitarian, really. So
just very briefly, then we'll open it up for a few questions. Not trying to pick on any particular media, but in particular, I saw a CARE 11 report last night that said that Nathaniel Spector, one of the defendants,
Secor,
was responsible for breaking the window at Macy's, and it showed a picture of a masked individual putting a pole through the window at Macy's in downtown St. Paul. And of course, Nathaniel was in jail when that occurred. The report also indicated that everyone but one person was from outside of Minnesota. In fact, we have a lifelong resident of the Mankato area, several lifelong residents of Minneapolis. Everyone with substantial ties to the community, with friends, allies, and supporters. Those of you who may have seen the house raids go down on Saturday saw the tremendous support of neighbors of the community that turned out and said, you know, I know the people that live here. They haven't done anything wrong. Why don't you go bother with the crack den three houses down? Why are you raiding this house here? Why are you harassing those people? Why are you pointing guns in my neighborhood in the middle of the day? The police response, the prosecutor's response, the charges that are filed, the riot police in the street are out of all proportion to anything that the facts support. And we'll open it up for some questions.
Would you say this is a pattern of violence on the part of the police or random actions by specific police? How would you characterize that?
I don't think we're really speaking to the overall week right now. I mean, there's certainly a pattern of violence by the authorities directed towards these individuals, breaking into houses at 8 a.m. with assault rifles and shotguns, putting people face down, pointing guns at them, pointing guns at children that were in the houses, and denying them access to the courts through the timing, speaking to neighbors who had guns pointed at them. We had other warrants executed that were similar at a convergent space where there's only literature was taken out. Literature which was ordered, some of which was recovered, but which the Ramsey County attorney, the same agency that's prosecuting these eight people, argued that that literature could not be released, argued that that literature, today in federal court in front of Judge Thunheim, they argued that that literature was not protected by the First Amendment. That literature that described the political beliefs, because it discussed violence, was an incitement to violence and was not protected. It's in clear contravention to the United States Constitution and the United States Supreme Court. But the same prosecuting agency that is bringing criminal charges against these individuals for their political activity is the prosecuting agency that said that that political material, that written literature, was not protected by the First Amendment. And that shows the value or the lack of that value placed on the First Amendment by the Ramsey County Attorney's Office. So in that sense, there's a pattern that these people... The rest of the week is a broader thing to be discussed in other places.
Although I think it's important to note that this was a very well planned and coordinated effort at repression and control of political dissent. You can see the sheriff had people in probably other agencies had people spying on the RNC welcoming committee a year or two before this happened, that they had a very heavy intelligence operation where they were spying on them. They put all that investment into them, into that, which now they have to make it, have something to show for it by prosecuting people. And that was combined with, you know, with tremendous plans and money that was spent to use force to repress people also, where you have the $50 million federal grant that came in, $1.9 million of which was spent on chemical spray. And if you were in that street, you'd see the huge amounts of chemical spray that went in that street. So, you know, I do it. I think you're getting at something, that this is part of a pattern that gets connected, because it's all part of the effort of these government agencies to use all this money that's available in the name of terrorism and spend it on repressing political dissent in many different ways that are related.
This is Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We continue our broadcast from the Multicultural Indigenous Academy in downtown St. Paul, where several blocks away, the Republican National Convention is underway. It's Thursday, and the candidates, the nominee of the Republican parties, are in town. The President of the United States, George W. Bush, and the Vice President are on their way, if they're not here already. In this school where we have been broadcasting from, we only need look out the window to see the massive police presence, federal police presence, Homeland Security. We've even seen hundreds of troops in trains. The city is in an almost near lockdown. There have been hundreds of arrests, and it seems like it's only getting worse. The kids in this school, there are actually two schools in this building, have been frightened, some terrorized. Some of these kids have had experiences outside of the school with the police and police violence. And now we want to invite some of the teachers of this school to talk about their concerns and their response to what's been going on here and how it's impacted on the situation, their situation, and trying to work with the kids. I'm going to ask one at a time. I want to talk with you both. I'm going to ask you to lean into the microphone, tell us your name, tell us what you teach, and then share a little bit about your experiences and your reaction to what's going on.
My name is Louis Alamayu, and I'm the language arts teacher in this school, and I do some administration. It's been somewhat stressful, but I think because I'm one of the older people on staff, I'm kind of a refugee from the 1960s and 70s. Seeing this kind of thing, although this is nothing I've ever seen before, I think after a while you kind of learn to try and stay very rooted and calm, watch things happen, have the reactions you need to, try and keep everybody safe and advise them as best you can. Our students, because they are low income and of color, they've had a lot of interactions with the police department, with juvenile justice system. I think I find that they're somewhat irritated by this presence. Because they're resilient, they just keep on moving and sometimes ask questions about it, but I think they really need to learn more about where we are at in terms of this point in history and how things might be unfolding and how they need to be prepared to be strong leaders.
My name is Al Papalamaikali Mesa. I'm a social studies teacher here at Multicultural Indigenous Academy. I guess thinking back about a week ago last Monday when I came into my new classroom, I had noticed outside my classroom that there was a camera that was there that hadn't existed before. As I thought about it, I was like, I wonder if this is going to leave after the NRC, because this wasn't here before. And then this weekend when I had come to school to do some work, there was heavy police presence that made me feel very uncomfortable coming into the building. And when I was here on Monday downtown to participate in an anti-war protest with my daughter, It was very uncomfortable because they were lining up in riot gears, two by two. Just that energy was flowing, and I just was looking around just thinking, I'm at a place where I work at. This is a community that I grew up in. I used to come down here and play as a child, and I'm here with my daughter getting ready to go participate in a peaceful protest, and I have to decide, do I have to completely reroute myself to get to where I need to, or do I figure out walking between them with my four-year-old daughter? So I was thinking about that as Tuesday approached. Okay, what are these students going to have to face when they come in here? Because none of our students, to my knowledge, live downtown. The majority of them take a bus from one of the surrounding communities, and so I'm sure they've been rerouted. So I was, I don't know if I want to say concerned, but I just had some apprehension about what they were going to experience. Were they even going to make it here? I did get a text from one of my students on Tuesday. It said, "Hi, Elle, this is Anna," and she just told me that she wasn't coming to school that the next day. She wanted to know if we were open, but she wanted me to know that she wouldn't be here because things were crazy downtown. That's what she had heard. And that made me sad. That made me sad that it was the beginning of our year coming back after a summer and knowing that we were told that we should release our students at 12:30. We should only have half days the first week of school because of what was going on. So our students were limited in their education this first week. I had a student calling me who's never called me over the summer or last spring to let me know that, hi, I'm here, I will be coming, but I can't go down there this week. And meeting the students that came, the new students and some of the returning students, I don't know how much they did, they have interacted with the police. A lot of them seem to kind of think like, well, or appear that this is kind of what we're used to. We're used to having to go around police or watch our back when we see police. But they're still coming. So I guess that's it for now.
Did it affect the way you started teaching with the students that arrived? Does it turn into a civics lesson? Do you try and teach based on what's happening here?
We've altered our schedule completely this week. We haven't had classes as usual. We have created a schedule that's unique to this week. We've opened up our day with ceremonies, welcoming the students, breaking off in our cultural heritage groups that we offer here. We offer a Chicano-Latino cultural heritage group class, African-American cultural heritage circle, and Native American cultural heritage circle. So we've done some time in those classes and then coming together as a group. And we had a guest speaker today, and we've done some art classes. So it's completely altered this week. Will it turn into a civics lesson this year? Of course. That's my intention, is to focus on, you know, what's going on, what's around us, and what are we in the middle of.
There's a lot of ways where in our school the classroom becomes the streets too, the neighborhood. We need to make sure that the people resources are very much a part of how we educate and inform our students.
Órale, my name is Jesus Ramirez, and saludos a todos allá en Califas. From East LA originally, I'm teaching out here in St. Paul. And, well, where do you start at, huh? Well, it starts off like this. Check it out. It was a Monday, and when I arrived, I was upstairs cleaning up the room and stuff. And so I'm all my music blaring, and then I decided to go downstairs real quick. And as I walk outside, there's like these guys that look like RoboCop. The ratos are tall, too. They're like 8 feet tall, I swear to you. And they all have their suits on and stuff, and they're all getting ready. It's a bunch of minivans. So, and a couple of them peeing on the side of our building, which I thought was ironic because that way they were showing me the respect they have for this barrio. And I looked on the side of their vans, and none of their vans had, you know, St. Paul on there. They all said Edina, which is like a nice, rich suburb out here. And the vatos were very tall. I looked around, and not one person of color. It was interesting to see all these vatos about to put it down on a barrio that they're not from, taller than us, with suits showing authority. So I go out there and I tell this one guy, hey, can I take you guys' picture or what? He said, yeah, only if you catch my good side. So I said, I can't take your picture then, right? Because I didn't see a good side on that, homie. So he started to laugh a little bit. I kept on walking, taking some pictures. And then I shot back up. I started thinking about what was cracking. So I'm cleaning my room, and about 2 hours later, I look out my window, and there's like 7 chavalitos running down the street. And there's this series of riot cops shooting out there, and all you hear is the bangs going off. So I look out the window, and it's literally a bunch of cops, I mean a bunch of cats down on the floor. And I said, right outside of school like that? The Multicultural Indigenous Academy? Chale. And they were all on the outside, and this happened 3 times that day. So I'm over here putting together my class with my pictures of Zapata, you know. I'm putting the pictures up of the little mijos back in the Revolutionary War. And I'm looking outside at the same time there's riots outside on the street. It was a trip. It was a reality of what's going down out here. On that level, I mean, how is it not going to impact the first week of school? How do you look at the little mijos and say, you know what? This is what's going down in your own neighborhood, and this is the history part of it. By the way, I teach advanced biology. I teach biology, environmental science. I co-facilitate with the Cultural Heritage Circle, and I teach an art class in Chicano studies. So those are some of the dynamics.
Well, Jesus, let me ask you. Say you're from East L.A., and it's been shown in East L.A. that the police actually have gangs. They mark themselves as gangs. I imagine you thought you were leaving some of that behind. Here, I would imagine, though, that your students have had some experiences outside of the classrooms that would make them frightened of police power. Did you think about that? Have you heard anything about that? Or how would you go about expressing that concern?
Sure. You know what? Leading up to the convention, it's been interesting that you bring that up, because there's been an increase in the amount of gang task force that's been going on. And some of the tactics that's been happening as far as gang task force goes is that's been picking up a lot of the youth and then dropping them off in the opposite neighborhoods, making them fly their colors and telling them to go on their ways. And this was literally within 2 months before the RNC ended up arriving. So I think what's ended up happening is a conquer-divide situation when they end up making it very difficult for the kids, hemming them up as much as you possibly can, get them out of the city, get them out of the way, and then bringing in the cops in there soon after. So now you got the riot police that are here trying to situate the situation or trying to calm down the situation. But prior to that, the officers had a lot of attention to going on with the youth that was going on. And the reality is that our school, being the school that it is, it naturally pulls in a lot of students that may have not taken care of their credits for one reason or another, which is typically the youth of the inner city, which are exactly those that were being hemmed up at one point. So being the teacher that I am, I liked being their family member as well. So I was always hearing, yeah, you know, drip out last week, they ended up dropping us off over there, and I got hemmed up over here, and the cop ended up dropping me off over there and telling me to get my own ride home. I said, is that right? So you start hearing a lot of stuff that's happening to the youth out on the street on the regular. And when that started happening, and then with the riots and the RNCs going on now, it all seems to be making sense. So those are some of the things I've heard from my youth.
Al, what about your kids, is there a concern that this will only enhance or make worse their fear of authority, their fear of the police? As kids were told, you know, something goes wrong, we get in trouble outside, we call the police. There's an emergency, somebody comes hurt, gets hurt, we call the police. Is there a concern that people will hesitate? There might be a situation where these kids are frightened, something terrible is happening, but they won't call the police?
Yeah, and I think that's also very real in our communities prior to this present anyways, just because of how police have treated our communities in general and the communities that and families of the children that we work with. So I've heard that in the past as well, that, you know, we don't get the police involved. I did have a student the other day that said to me, I was trying to tell him about these great concerts and all this great music that's going on around us, and wanted to give them an opportunity to participate in this because Michael Franti was here, Rage Against the Machine, Dead Prez, Mos Def, different Los Nativos were performing. And as I was telling him, he said, you know what, I really don't even want to be down here. And it just broke my heart. And I'm like, this is such great music that you deserve to hear. And it most of it's free and it's in your neighborhood and people are putting it on. And I didn't go into that conversation with them because he had told me what his boundary was because his experience from the police, because of experience of being hemmed up, just walking in his neighborhood on the west side. So I I do think that this is going to impact more fear, and you know who I don't want to bring these the police officers into my community. I don't want to ask them for help because they haven't shown me that they help my community in general.
One thing I heard today is that one of our young women who, well, she spotted her rapist this week, reported it to the police, and she was told they couldn't really do anything about it until the RNC was gone. They don't have the staff to follow up on the fact that her rapist has been spotted, and they even have a record of him as being, you know, a sexual criminal, but it's on hold until the Republicans are gone.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking to you from St. Paul, Minnesota. Some people are referring to it now as the great police state of St. Paul, Minnesota, where the Republican National Convention is underway just a couple of blocks from here. We are at the Multicultural Indigenous Academy, where an academy, an alternative school for indigenous folks, people of color, people who couldn't make it in a traditional educational system that is coming apart at the seams, particularly in the inner city and urban areas. As we talk to you, we can tell you that all levels of police are acting. There have been warnings. We heard from sources inside the police department that there's going to be a serious crackdown today. We have observed trainloads full of soldiers, full of National Guard. We've seen Navy SEALs in boats, in the rivers, in the lake. So it is an amazing situation and a setting to start your first day of school, and we're talking with three teachers who are trying to work in the context of this kind of brutality that happens right outside the window. And anybody who wants to jump in, but I haven't had much of a chance to look at television or see much of what's going on in terms of the media, but I've been out in the streets and we've seen everything from police attacks to literally shooting, opening fire into demonstrations where people are totally peaceful, doing nothing wrong, and all of a sudden concussion bombs, bean bags, rubber bullets are being shot. So this kind of violence is definitely filtering into the kids' minds. And I'm wondering what this might mean for their future and how this might impact on their ability just to think clearly about their studies and what's going on. Jesus?
Sure. You know what? First thing I want to bring up clear is that, you know what? It's heavy out here, but there's not this whole thing of I'm a victim falling upon myself or a lot of our youth. The reality is what's going down is that this is our barrio and we own it. The reality, we live in it and we own it and we're not letting nobody take from it. So I'm sorry I get a little passionate about those things because that's what it's all about and that's what I teach the kids on the regular. On that note, what you just mentioned right now, you imagine the military being around your block, homie. You imagine not being able to go down the street or take your little daughter out to the Excel. That's not right. It's not right. And we're making calls out and we're organizing stuff. And just last night, I was calling the mayor's office. And I was organizing people to call the mayor's office and say, you know what? You're the leader in this situation. You're the leader of the city right now. You need to address this. Why am I not able to take my little mijos out? We can't go to the museum. Why am I have to go ahead and go around all a good mile off just to get home? Why am I not able to take my kid to the Children's Museum? Because of my skin color. But because there's a huge fence that's 11 foot in there. Because I don't have the I don't have the money to support some people in the RNC. Was my skin my sin from the get-go? And if that's the case, I'm seeing it in front of me, my eyes, right now. I know we talk about it when it's not here, but right now it's in my face on a daily basis. And I cannot and will not allow them to dictate how I feel and what I'm going to do. I'm going to be who I am, and this is my streets, and that's exactly what I tell our kids. But these vatos, they're heavy, and they're right in front of our face. So some of us just have to soldier up and say, this is where we live, and this is how we're going to organize against it. Do not allow it to take from you. Do not allow them to change your emotions. Allow yourself to move forward. But it's hard. Like my brother said right now, we got literally Navy SEALs out there and the lakes and the rivers and stuff, and how does it not, you know, it's a hard, big cloud just sitting on top of us.
You know, Louis, I want to come back to the story that you just shared with us in terms of your student recognizing her rapist. This is a significant situation because it also may mean that the rapist recognized the student. If the rapist or the alleged rapist thinks that the student knows who the rapist is, and there's a lot of time between this is dealt with, that puts your student in jeopardy. I'm wondering if she feels in jeopardy because of that.
Yes, she feels threatened. But, you know, as a staff, that's like one of the things that we deal with on a daily basis in terms of the lives of our students outside of the classroom and those things that become obstacles to them being able to be good students. So we have to pay attention to those things and address those things and give them advice. Go to court with them, give them a ride home, you know, whatever. I mean, there's limitless number of things that we might have to do in order to give support to our students. But, you know, it's like the violence that they're seeing, it's nothing new to them. And I think that what we try and tell them or teach them is that the country that they live in was born in violence. The colonization that their ancestors and they and what they now are experiencing started long ago, and it's continuing. You have to look at it in terms of what are you being fed every day? Are you being fed violence every day in your entertainment, in the politics? What choices do you have to make? If you are committing violence, are you supporting the system or opposing it? Think about it. Analyze it. Here's some information to consider. What do you need to do for yourself, your family, and your community to thrive?
As I'm sitting here thinking about one of my students had said earlier about the police presence and just kind of how normal it is to have the police presence in their lives. She made a comment that the other day when she was leaving, she was two blocks up the street from our school, and she said one of the police officers told her, "Go on the other side of the street, you." And she's saying this in class, and some of the students are like, "No, they didn't really say that." And other students are like, "Yeah, I think they said it." And someone else said, "Well, that doesn't bother me." And so they were debating about whether or not she was telling the truth, whether or not it bothered some people that a police officer called her a and whether or not she was okay with it or who would have done what. I was just sitting back watching this like, wow, you know, this is where we're at. You know, we have police officers saying this to our students, and then we have students also wondering whether or not that's okay. Does it bother them? And it just, I think it really says a lot about how much the police impact our students' lives on a very negative tip on a daily, because first of all, that word has so much violence behind it, and then people dressed in riot gear saying that to anyone, regardless of what your ethnic background is, it's very intimidating, one, just to see them dress the riot squad gear and then hear them using that language. I'm like, how terrifying for this young person to have to experience that. So I just wanted to say that and talk about that because that's still on my mind.
All right, we're going to leave it right here. This is a very important conversation, and I'm very much in appreciation to the three teachers here from the Multicultural Indigenous Academy, and Louis and Al and Jesus. You do great work here at the Academy. I know you have a tough job. I've been a teacher myself for 15 years. Under the best of circumstances, it's hard to teach. In this context, it's made a great deal more difficult, and we thank you as teachers for your commitment, and we wish you the best helping to secure our future by working with the people who will be a part of it. Thanks both for being with us on Flashpoints.
Thank you very much.
You.
Thank you for having us.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is Dennis Bernstein broadcasting to you from some undisclosed location in St. Paul, Minnesota, with our honorary co-host Bill Means, Miguel Gavilan Molina, and the entire Flashpoints crew, and our technical wizard, Falco Molina. Stay tuned to Free Speech Radio.